Welcome to the University of East Anglia Pioneer Podcast, where we find out how UEA is tackling the world's greatest challenges and transforming lives with help from our generous philanthropists through the Difference Campaign. This is episode 2 of a short series about the unique work on prostate cancer, which is happening at the Bob Champion Research and Education Building. Last time, we learnt how Professor Colin Cooper and his team became the first in the UK to look in depth at how cancer genetics could help with the diagnosis of prostate cancer. This has led to the development of 2 tests, which could eventually help save and improve the lives of millions of men around the world. In this episode, we'll find out more about these tests and how Professor Colin Cooper and his team look set to crack the problem of predicting whether your particular type of prostate cancer is aggressive or not.
Statistically, it was striking. It's very, very clear that the data were true. It's very, very clear that it actually solved the problem that we've been trying to solve for 20 years.
We'll hear from some of those working on the project, the mind-blowing complexities.
I think the only people that use latent process decomposition on this type of data probably will be about 4 people. So yeah, we're the only people in the world doing this thing at this time.
Plus, the earthier side of things.
So when a man has a wee, these secretions get flushed out. If a cancer is present in the prostate, then little tiny parts of the cancer get carried with the secretions and they get flushed out with the urine. So we collect the urine and then we sieve them out of the urine, like when you pour peas into a colander, but on a very much smaller scale.
And we'll hear from one man who knows what it's like to live with the disease.
I said I've got typical old man's disease. I go to the toilet often, but don't pee a lot because that's the way it is when you're an old man.
But first, let's catch up with Professor Colin Cooper, who heads up the research. We're going to hear more about the successes, yes, multiple, not just one, but 2 discoveries that, with enough support, will change the outcomes of men with prostate cancer worldwide. As you'll discover, he's a man who's in a race against time. He's already regretful that he didn't reach these scientific conclusions sooner.
We had some ideas that this approach might be useful. We looked at it as early as 2007, but we never really got to do the experiment until about 8 years later. And that's kind of a bit of a regret because we didn't really understand that it would solve the problem in the way that it did. There are many ideas that fly around and sometimes you can fit them in and sometimes you can't. And we just had to wait till we could fit this idea in. It turned out to be the right idea, and it was just very difficult to predict that in advance.
Nevertheless, you get the impression he still kicks himself. But he needn't. There were a few things that needed to be in place in order to get to where he was going. The first was the technology to help understand which of the 20,000 genes in the human genome were switched on or off. That's called a microarray scanner. Scientists elsewhere had used it to find out more about breast cancer. I'll let the professor take it from here.
And what you do is you take a little piece of breast cancer the size of a pea, and then you mush it up, you kind of homogenise it, and then you prepare the material that you want from that. In this case, it's something called RNA, which is messenger RNA, which is encoded by the DNA. And you put it onto the microarray, and every gene in your genome, all 20,000, it will tell you whether the gene's on or off. And they found that when you looked at the data together, you found that breast cancer is divided into 3 categories. One of the categories was called basal breast cancer, and this is a cancer that has very poor prognosis. A second was called luminal, and this is breast cancer that you would treat by estrogen withdrawal therapy. And there's a third group called ERBB overexpressing. And so there were 3 groups. Now, people have tried to do this with prostate cancer, and they've never had any success. And there's a whole line of papers saying, oh yeah, we've done this experiment, taken 100 prostate cancers, we've prepared the RNA, we put it onto microarrays, we've analysed results, we don't see any categories at all.
But Professor Cooper was convinced the microarray could help. He thought the reason it was difficult to isolate the different types of prostate cancer was because it has a different structure to breast cancer. Think of it like two different kinds of sweets. Stick with me here. A soft, squishy, pink all the way through marshmallow versus a colourful, multi-layered licorice allsort.
Prostate cancer is very heterogeneous. So a single cancer is made up of many different parts, each of which has a different property. So the way you can visualise this is to consider breast cancer is a bit like a marshmallow, so that one breast cancer of a particular type will be pretty much like another breast cancer of a particular type. It's the same all the way through. And this is what allowed the categories to be identified. In the case of prostate cancer is more like a licorice allsort. It's made up of several different bits, and the size of those bits can vary depending on the particular cancer that you're looking at.
So, once mushed up and studied on a microarray, the licorice allsort type sample would just become a murky grey colour, a mix of the original structure of black, pink and white, impossible to identify or categorise what it originally looked like. Ah, but don't give up yet. Here comes the maths.
But it turns out that if you had the results of 100 or 200 of those, and you have some very clever maths called latent process decomposition, you can reconstruct what the prostate cancer or what the licorice allsort looks like from the mush that you had to start with. First, the maths told us, yes, the samples you're looking at do have structure. And then it took a very, very long time for it to reconstruct what the cancers looked like. And when we got the results, we really didn't believe it, actually, to start with, because there was one component, which we actually called descent cancer, or the tiger component, that whenever it was present, the patient did really badly. So there were four of us. There was Bogdan Luca, who'd won a maths and computing prize in Romania. There was the head of the computing section. There was a maths genius called Dan Brewer, and myself. And the four of us, we met once a week for over a year, and we were discussing this data. And every week, one of us would come up with a problem with it and say, oh, yeah, it can't be right because of this. And then we'd go away. And then at the end of the year, you know, we couldn't think of anything else, basically, to pull it down. And we all started to believe it then, because it just seemed so unlikely that this had been missed, because it was, statistically, it was striking. It's very, very clear that the data were true. It's very, very clear that it was highly relevant to cancer patients. It's very, very clear that it actually solved the problem that we've been trying to solve for 20 years, which was how to tell the aggressive cancers from the non-aggressive cancers. And that was, I think that was one of the best discoveries of my career, certainly. It meant we had success in addressing the problem that we've been trying to solve for two decades.
I think that's the most exciting discoveries you make, when it's something that you can't believe is true.
This is Dan Brewer, one of the four in the room who couldn't believe what they'd discovered.
And this was, in ways, we thought was too good to be true. But we kept battering it, bringing in more data to try and prove that it was wrong, because that's your natural instinct as a scientist, is you're trying to prove wrong what you've discovered because you want to be really sure about it. And we kept throwing things at it, and it stuck. And I strongly believe that it's a real thing and it can be used, which is the most important thing, to help patients.
Dan's a key member of Professor Colin Cooper's team.
I'm a senior lecturer in medical bioinformatics and genomics, based here at the University of East Anglia in the Norwich Medical School.
I've also looked on your Twitter feed, where you refer to yourself as a cancer bioinformatician. Now, that can't be a title that's used by many people in the world.
There'll be a surprisingly large number, but not that many, I suppose. They're probably in the hundreds rather than the thousands. So it's really doing applied mathematics in the area of biology and medicine. So it's like, if you think about physics is sort of like applying maths to physical things like balls rolling down hills, engineering and all that stuff. Well, bioinformatics is just the same, but it's applying mathematics and statistics to biological problems.
You say you're pretty good at maths. Now, I have it from Professor Colin Cooper that you are a maths genius. So you're going to have to wear that hat, I'm afraid.
I think Colin might exaggerate to a certain extent there.
And if there's one thing you want people to take away from this, apart from all the very important information, it's that you do not wear a white coat and you do not go into a lab.
That is very true. I sit at a desk all day, every day. And in the research that I'm doing, I'm interacting with computers, both my own laptop and on other desktops, but more importantly, with a huge computer that's based at the University of East Anglia that is really a huge multiple of different computers all linked together.
So when you say supercomputer, I have visions of the 1940s, 1950s computers that take up a whole room. Tell me what it looks like.
To be honest, I haven't actually seen the one that we currently work on, but it is very much like a room of blinking lights. I don't know if you've seen those on films and stuff. It is, they have racks and racks of these long, thin computers with flashing lights. There's probably 300 or so of these computers all linked together into a big supercomputer. And to give you an idea, so a normal computer these days probably has about 16 gigabytes of memory. And each one of these nodes will have probably 256 gigabytes of memory. And there's sort of like hundreds of these that you can access at the same time. So it's really in a very much in a different league.
And the reason he needs to use this supercomputer is because Dan Brewer's in charge of the maths. The maths which helped identify the aggressive prostate cancer, which the team nicknamed the Tiger, over the less aggressive, the Pussycat. So the other thing that we must take away from our chat today is a term which everyone must commit to memory, latent process decomposition. Tell us about that.
It's catchy, isn't it? Yeah, so this is the algorithm that we've used to detect and actually to characterise the Tiger test, identifying the subtype that is associated with a worse outcome than the other cancers. And it's all based on Bayesian clustering. So the central idea is that there's not one fixed answer, but there's actually a spread of answers that you have different amounts of certainty that it is either true or false.
So how's that used when it comes to genes? It's a huge concept to get your head around, and sometimes even Dan Brewer gets a little confused.
Now, latent process decomposition is an algorithm that separates out samples. It's quite a complicated thing, and even I have trouble getting my head around it. I have to reread it again just to make sure that I understand it. But the basic idea is that by applying this algorithm, we can pick up on patterns in these genes turning on, off and on. And then we can assign a particular sample. We can say, okay, it looks like there's a 80% chance that this patient has got this the subtype of the Tiger test that we think is going to have a worse outcome. I mean, the key thing is that you can't find it from just looking at one sample, these patterns. But if you look at hundreds of these samples, you can pick up on the patterns. And then once you've got that information about what the patterns are, then you can apply it to just one sample and extract the information about what the dominant process that's driving the cancer is.
And the test itself is a biopsy, is that right?
Yeah. So when you get your biopsy, when you're being diagnosed, then we'll take that material, we'll then mash it up, and we'll extract something from it called RNA, which is a way of telling us how much a gene is turned on or off. And then using that RNA, we will go through a bit of a process, but then it's put on what's called a microarray machine. And the microarray measures how much on and off we have from every single gene that is present in a cell. And then using that information, that then goes into the LPD, the latent process decomposition model that we've got, and then out will spit out a number between 0 and 1 for whether it's a tiger or not.
But of course, nobody can benefit directly from these tests at this stage, as Dan Brewer explains.
The key thing that's really driving us now is, OK, we've got this really interesting finding. How do we get it into the clinic? And that's really what we're pushing on right now. And to do that, the first step is to set up a diagnostics lab. So for this, we've been kindly donated money to get the microarray machine and the other technical things that we need. We're employing a excellent guy that has sorted out all the protocols and the instructions on how to do this in a rigorous way that is reproducible and that will be approved by the government. So you have to meet all these criteria to use this test in the clinic. And that's really what we're focused on now, is making sure it's robust, making sure it's reproducible, that when we say to a clinician, okay, there's this score from the tiger test and you really need to take it seriously, then that's actually a true result.
And how many other people in the world use the kind of maths that you use in the way that you use it? Do you know?
So if you're going to be really precise, then I think the only people that use latent process decomposition on this type of data probably will be about four people. All of them apart from one is based in Norwich. So yeah, if we're going to extend it to Bayesian algorithms on biological data, then we're probably talking about 100 people or so.
But really, it is very unique what's going on at the UEA at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're the only people in the world doing this thing at this time.
And I mean, how's that feel? You probably don't say that to yourself an awful lot, but how's it feel when I say it to you?
To be honest, it feels a bit weird, but yeah. I mean, I suppose it's the job of the scientist to do something that's novel and something that's interesting and something that's useful.
But you very much believe in it, and everyone who's part of the project believes in going down this specific route of setting up your own diagnostic lab, which is really quite unique as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult job getting things that are true and things that are interesting into the clinic. And rightfully so, because you don't want to make life and death decisions based on something that you can't be certain about. And it's essential to be able to get the tiger test into something that's useful.
I remember when my dad was diagnosed in February 2018, all of a sudden everyone seemed to have it. And there was Stephen Fry posting his famous video saying he'd been diagnosed, the BBC presenter Bill Turnbull too. And we didn't know it at the time, but Rod Stewart was in the early stages of treatment for it then as well. I mean, it's definitely becoming easier to talk about, but there are things that people still find tricky. I mean, interfering with the prostate can have some really difficult impacts on a man's personal life. And I mean, these are kind of unquantifiable, but potentially, you know, things like impotence and incontinence, your test could have a huge impact with.
Yeah, if you're diagnosed with prostate cancer, because the prostate occurs at the centre of plumbing, as it were, so this is why it's really, really important to have a test that will tell you whether you should have that operation or not, because you want to avoid the side effects. And the important, critical thing with cancer is to treat it at a very early stage. And if you have any thought at all that you might have prostate cancer, rush to your GP.
Told you do a voluntary job as well. I help the National Health Service as well, you see. I'm a blood biker, which can be pretty intensive as well.
Trevor Beckford, who we met in episode one, is a 69-year-old former criminal lawyer who's about to retire but can't quite let go of the cut and thrust of life.
So, pretty energetic life.
I've lived off adrenaline. What's going to happen when I no longer generate adrenaline? I don't know, to be honest.
So does that mean you also do biking? That's one of your hobbies, is it?
I'm a motorcyclist, yeah.
Right. Yes. So plenty of adrenaline. So tell me about when you started to feel unwell.
For prostate cancer. Well, that's funny because I never felt unwell at all.
In fact, it was only by accident that he came to even mention any prostate issues to the doctor.
But I was talking to him and he actually said, is there anything else you want to talk to me about? And I mentioned something and I said, perhaps you can just help me. Because we hear at the moment a lot of times about if you've got the symptoms of prostate cancer, go and see your doctor and get yourself checked out and tested. And I said, I'm perfectly happy to do that. What are the symptoms? None of the announcements they ever say tell you what the symptoms are. So how do I know if I've got symptoms if I don't know what the symptoms are? And he went, ah, he says, that's all a questionnaire about how you go to the toilet, how you pee. So I said, oh, and this is how I always thought it. I said, I've got typical old man's disease. I go to the toilet often, but don't pee a lot because that's the way it is when you're an old man, you see. There was nothing, and it wasn't uncomfortable. It was just bloody inconvenient because, you know, you would go to the toilet, you would not pee anything like as much as you wanted to. It would take an age to come out because it was much more of a dribble. And then, you know, half an hour later without having drunk anything else, you'd be busted to go to the toilet again. And that was frustrating. And he said, well, just fill out this questionnaire. So I filled out the questionnaire and I came back on that as medium risk. And so he said, I'd better do a PSA test for you, a check for you. So that was the first time I had a PSA.
The dreaded PSA. It stands for prostate-specific antigen, and it's a protein that's only made by the prostate. The PSA test is currently the first method doctors have of testing for prostate cancer currently.
And when you have cancer, you get a raised amount of this PSA protein in the bloodstream. So the cancer doesn't actually make more of it, but because the cancer disrupts the tissue in the prostate, it becomes more leaky, and that's why you get PSA raised in the bloodstream.
That's scientist Dr. Jeremy Clark, lead researcher in Professor Colin Cooper's prostate cancer diagnosis team. He's not a big fan of the PSA.
If you ride in a horse, the position of the prostate means that you can get pressure on it. That can lead to raised PSAs. So there's a lot of reasons why PSA can be raised. And also the prostate grows as you get older. So just because it's a larger volume, your PSA increases as you get older anyway. So if you just do PSA tests on people off the street and then did biopsies on them, 70% of those would not have cancer on biopsy. Is that bad in a way? So yes, there's something needed to be better than PSA.
And he's been working on a new test that would, at the very least, help supplement the PSA. I'm going to make your head swell a bit by saying that Professor Colin Cooper says you are one of the most exceptional teams he's ever worked with in his career. So how about that?
I don't think he's worked many.
Well, you may just be being modest there. But he was saying to me that you were incredibly talented, and it's very much down to the personnel and the team spirit as to, you know, where you've got to today.
Yeah, Colin's great, actually. He's really easy to work with. He's, you know, he lets you go off and chase things that, you know, turn out to be good or turn out to be bad. So that's, you know. Yeah.
And that's what you need, isn't it? That sort of confidence to inspire you to follow your nose.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, it's when you find results that don't match with what you expect, that's where all the good stuff is, and that's the bits you have to chase. You don't just say, oh, it doesn't fit, I'll ignore that. That's the bit you actually need to investigate. I see it like a detective sort of story. If you've, you know, there's a dead body in the room and you have to sort of find out who done it and what happened, really. And it's that sort of thing with lots of red herrings, and then you find out what's going on, you hope.
And what's going on is the development of a test using men's urine, unlike PSA, which is a blood test. What can men's urine tell us?
So the prostate sits just below the bladder. It's a secretory organ. It's got little sort of vessels and tubes all over it, which the secretions flow down to, and these feed into the urethra, you know, just below the bladder. So when a man has a wee, these secretions get flushed out. If a cancer is present in the prostate, then little tiny parts of the cancer get carried with the secretions and they get flushed out with the urine. So we collect the urine and we can then examine them for the presence of cancer, looking for these biomarkers. So a biomarker is something like a marker, a biological marker, which in this case is for the prostate cancer.
How do you recognise the biomarker?
So we look at lots of cells in the body give out these tiny little microvesicles, and it's like a little sort of messaging system where they send letters to each other, and they have little sort of addresses on the outside, and it can get taken up by target cells. And these little microvesicles contain RNA sequences, which are gene expressed sequences. And the cells in the body use it to talk to each other and also to alter the how the cells look. So cancer uses the same system to benefit itself and so it can grow better and to spread. And these little microvesicles that are given out get carried with the secretions again, and they get flushed out in the urine, and then we sieve them out of the urine like you when you pour peas into a colander, but on a very much smaller scale. So we sieve the microvesicles out of the urine, and then we extract the RNA from that.
The RNA shows whether a gene is switched on or off. The team analysed the findings and found patterns which helped predict aggressive and non-aggressive cancers.
And Dan Brewer did the analysis on the data we gained from this. This was a Movember-funded study. And we came up with four signatures, one for non-cancer, one for low risk, one for high risk, and then there's an intermediate risk, which is the ones between the low and the high. And we found that the high-risk signature, the PUR4 signature, PUR stands for prostate urine risk, was associated with aggressive cancer. And also in an active surveillance cohort, so these are men who have low-grade cancer, it could predict up to 5 years later which men were going to have disease that would progress that required intervention. So that's where we are at the moment.
So this test, which they call the prostate urine risk test, PUR for short, looks like being an incredible help in diagnosing prostate cancer. So that's the second test being developed at the University of East Anglia, which could help clinicians like Dr. Kate Manley make decisions about treatment for patients.
Well, I mean, urology is a fantastic speciality. I know it may not seem like the most glamorous job, but you really get a variety of, you know, you meet so many different patients.
Dr. Kate Manley is a surgeon specialising in urology. She could probably fix your radiator too.
Well, I mean, essentially it is pipes and plumbing, and you, it sounds silly, but there's an awful lot of overlap with what we do in a bit of plumbing. So we deal with the urinary tract, so kidneys, ureters, bladder, prostate, urethra.
Everything has to pass through, doesn't it? That's the main thing with your area of work. Yeah. Everything has to just keep flushing through, otherwise you get problems.
Yes, essentially. It is just like plumbing. If you've got a blockage in a pipe, the pressure will build up and that pressure will affect the organ above.
Kate works with Professor Cooper's team one day a week.
You know, historically, our prostate cancer diagnosis has been quite controversial, where we used to have just PSA, which, as you know, isn't very specific. So it poses quite a lot of challenges. And there's a lot of interest in making that process better, coming up with a better tool to help us diagnose men from the offset. And that's the other important aspect of our PER test, is that it actually can differentiate who's going to progress. You can counsel men much, much more effectively at the beginning of their treatment.
And when we were speaking earlier on, I hope you don't mind me saying, but, you know, it was obviously really moving to you that it takes such a long time sometimes for patients to get where they need to be. I wonder what it is that sort of keeps you up at night about prostate cancer and the way that it's currently diagnosed and treated.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just we have so much pressure on resources. We have obviously all these targets that we have to meet, and you know, very often the sort of individual patient's needs just fall by the wayside, and we're trying to just get the numbers through and get as many biopsies as we can do. And so it's important to remember that there's an individual, there's someone's dad or brother or whatever at the end of it, and they're worried. And, you know, I don't think we have necessarily the time to spend with patients.
She provides a bridge between the research and Norwich and Norfolk University Hospital. Specifically, she identifies which of her patients would be suitable for the clinical trial, which includes both PER and the Tiger test.
Working on something like this is incredible. I suppose translational research is a sort of a hot topic at the moment, and so that's driving kind of basic science discoveries into therapeutics. So stuff that people are coming up with in the lab, it's translating that into a direct benefit for the patients. And it's very exciting to see something that, you know, a few years ago is kind of a theory, and that we're getting closer to having a test you can just post someone at home and they wee in a pot and you can tell them what kind of, how bad their prostate cancer is. I mean, that's very exciting. Yeah, that's fantastic to see. But obviously we wouldn't be able to do any of it if the patients didn't give up their time to take part in the trial. It's quite sort of noble that people are giving up time and whatever to take part, when actually there might not be any direct benefit to them. They're just doing it for like people in the future. So that's pretty humbling that they're doing that.
Yes. What are those conversations like when you do identify someone who can help?
Well, a lot of people obviously want to know, can they get their results from the test? But because it's still in sort of validation stage, we haven't been approved to tell people their results. And it's very sad. I've had people from France and Germany and things emailing me saying, can I send you some samples for you to analyze? But obviously we can't tell them the results. So yeah, it's important if anyone's taking part in a trial, you have to have proper informed consent, and they have to know what they're taking part in, and how, if you're taking any samples of blood or urine, how are you going to store them, and you know, what's going to happen to the data. And I think it's important also to feed back to the patients that have taken part what our findings have been. So it's important to let people know, yes, you know, you have helped, you are part of a larger study, and this is what we found with your help.
And how do you identify those people? Because that's one of your roles, your research roles, isn't it?
So that's people, identify people coming into the PSA clinic. So pretty much everyone that comes to the PSA clinic, I'll review and look to see whether they're appropriate for the trial. And then they'll be approached to see if they want to take part. And it's interesting, people are quite keen to do this. So we have a recruitment rate of about 60 to 70%, which is pretty high for a trial where they're getting nothing back.
As Kate mentioned, the PER test involves peeing in a pot. And one of the great strides forward in 2021 was a specially designed home testing kit. It has now been sent to 12 sites around the world, including Germany, Italy, Canada, Scotland and Ireland, to help validate the findings of the pilot study. Dr. Jeremy Clark says a test which can be done at home rather than in a clinic could save the NHS both time and money in the diagnosis of prostate cancer.
So the kit we send out is something like £35. The analysis is probably going to be about £150, so possibly about £200 in total. But if the man comes into the clinic for all the other stuff, there's a hell of a lot of knock-on costs. There's a hell of a lot of staff involved. You have the biopsies, probably 3 or 4 people involved. Then you have to have the histopathologist to look at that. Then you have to feed the information back. And 30% of the men that turn up at the Raised PSA clinic at NNUH are negative for cancer on biopsy. So that's a hell of a lot of money saved there and then, really. So
that could be hundreds, maybe thousands?
It could be a lot, yeah. There's a costing in 2014 by NICE for biopsies, I think it's something like £600 something. So yeah, but it's all according to how good the test turns out to be. At the moment, it's going to be in parallel with those tests, and then we'll know whether it can replace it completely.
So this could represent a saving.
Yes, in time, money, and stress on the patient.
Do you think this could also be, in a way, a preventative measure, in that if it's so easy to use and you can do it at home, and, you know, you probably don't even have to have a conversation with anyone on the phone, even potentially. Do you think that might mean that men are more likely to take up a test if they have a little question mark in their heads?
Yeah, there's publications on this. If something can be done at home rather than come to the clinic, the uptake is much, much higher and people are much happier with it. So, yes, it suits everybody, really. But as I say, we're in the validation stage. We're not there yet. We need to validate the whole system and make sure that of what we're where we are already.
But in a couple of years' time, you know, it could be the case that there are men globally who are benefiting from this test.
Yes, exactly. Yes, I think so.
Which is quite a huge thing to sort of hold in your head when you're daily going into the lab.
Yeah, it could be a bit scary sometimes to think, oh, no, it's all rubbish, because you get that pops into your head every now and again. But I can't see this going to be rubbish, because just the way that the analysis has been done and the output for deciding which men on active events were going to progress or not was sort of blind tested. So we found their signature, then we split them into two groups, and then we looked to see if they'd progressed, and that's where we found an eightfold difference. So an eightfold difference in which cancer progressed and which ones didn't. And there's nothing in the clinic that can do that at this moment. Nothing at all. So this could be really huge.
As Dr. Jeremy Clark says, it could be huge. But how quickly could the work being done at UEA translate to the real world? We'll find out more in the next episode as we learn about the third and final phase of the research and how this can only happen with the power of philanthropy. But in the meantime, if you've been inspired to help get the research out of the lab and into hospitals and homes around the globe, please visit www.uea.ac.uk/difference or email giving@uea.ac.uk. But for now, from me, Claire Bowes, and the team at UEA, thanks for listening and goodbye.